here in the Vault of Horror, and this is the Vault Cast once again, Conversations in the Dark. Welcome back, and tonight, in Conversations in the Dark, I will be talking with Nate Yap, who is the owner slash writer of ClassicHorror.com, which is actually Classic-Horror.com. And I'd like to, I should mention that site has been, what, 10, 11 years going strong now?
It'll be 11 in June, yeah.
Okay, so it's got a lot of history behind it, and it's a great resource for information and reviews about classic horror movies, classic-horror.com. So glad to have you here this week, Nate.
I'm glad to be here, Brian.
And given the name of Nate's site, I think you can probably guess that what we're going to be talking about tonight is classic horror, which is something that I'm very excited to talk about. I'm a big fan of quote-unquote classic horror and haven't had too much of a chance to talk about it yet here in Conversations in the Dark, so I'm kind of excited for this. I think a lot of people are maybe intimidated by the idea of classic horror. I mean, why do you think it is?
There's certainly a different sort of film language to classic cinema of all sorts. I mean, you have you have much longer takes. You have filmmakers who are taking more time, and honestly, a lot of it can come off as hokey if you don't get yourself in the right mindset for it. There's this presumption, especially amongst American film fans. I feel that, you know, newer is better, that the way we're making films is the culmination of the last 100 or so years of filmmaking, but somehow it being that culmination means that what came before doesn't necessarily matter as much. There's a point at which films stop mattering for people, you know?
It's funny you say that, because I found the same thing, actually, in conversation with people, that there's this belief among some people, you know, a certain opinion, which I don't share, and I think a lot of people don't share, but there is a certain opinion that films have somehow been steadily improving in general over the past century, thereby meaning that movies being made now are by definition better than any movies that have come before, generally speaking, which I think is completely nonsensical and erroneous and a complete generalization. I think not only is that not true, but I would probably say that there have been eras, in my opinion, in previous movie history, which generally speaking produced better films than the films that are being made now. So there are certain eras that are better than others, in my opinion.
Well, you and I are both also very well-versed in films. I mean, you're doing a series over on Cinema Geek right now about 52 perfect films. I mean, you and I have watched a lot of movies, so we're kind of inured to that whole thing. You know, most of the people that we talk to are probably, you know, more casual film fans, and they're watching films that were made for their generation, which is perfectly fair. But it doesn't mean that there isn't value in the older films.
That's true. And actually, yeah, I wanted to mention that too, by the way, real quickly, that Nate also does have another blog called Cinema Geek, which I have been writing for as often as possible. I'd like to do it weekly. It doesn't always turn out that way. But it's a series called 52 Perfect Movies, which I hope that people will check out, where I sort of kind of ramble about, you know, 52 movies. I picked that because of the 52 weeks of the year, obviously, but movies that I feel are just absolutely perfect, literally, and without flaw. And I just sort of explain why. And the site is cinema-geek.blogspot.com, right?
Correct. It can also be reached by just going to cinema-geek.com. I've got a redirect there, but inadvertent plug. I just sort of...
Oh, that's fine. But actually, you reminded me of something. Now, maybe I guess it's because we've seen a lot of movies or whatever. I've had the experience of where I'll lend somebody out a DVD of a movie, let's say, from the 70s. And they will say to me, it was pretty good. It was good for a movie made back then. And I was kind of look at them, and especially if they're talking about the 70s, because in my opinion, it's just, I really feel like that era was probably the finest era for movies, at least so far. With the 30s maybe being a close second. But I think like to me, to say that, generally speaking, I find movies of the 70s to be superior to movies that are made now. And I'm not saying movie per movie, but I'm saying, you know, per capita, let's say.
Yeah, an overall feeling of, you know, the 70s is a very unique era. I'm not sure if I agree that necessarily that the 70s is as grand as you would have it, but I definitely see your viewpoint. The 70s is a turning point for cinema, I feel, actually right into the late 60s as well. So, yeah, I can definitely see where you're coming from there. But, yeah, today's movies, here's the thing. I don't go to the theaters to watch horror anymore. I just don't do it. I invariably walk out disappointed. it's sad to see what the horror genre has become. So that's kind of the reason why I've put my focus on the classics, not only because I grew up with them. I mean, my mom raised me on horror films like The Wolfman, Pit and the Pendulum, stuff like that. But also because there's just an aesthetic there. There's an aesthetic in the new films that doesn't touch me, that doesn't get me where horror films are supposed to get me, you know, in the visceral, I guess. But also, you know, they don't engage me intellectually, they don't engage me viscerally. Sometimes they disgust me, but that's not, to paraphrase Stephen King, that's the last place you go, you know? You try to scare, you try to shock, and then you try to gross out. And if you start with the gross out, you've got nowhere else to go.
Yeah, and I think that there's a certain subgenre of movies, certainly, that's developed in the last, say, 30, 40 years, that's the specialty. That's what they go for right out of the gate. And
I have no problem with blood, beasts, and boobs. I'll just get that right out there. I love a good one. When I have a few in me, it's fine.
I think... Yeah, there's a certain type of horror film now that will do that, and quite frankly, they couldn't. You know, I mean, there was a time, you know, pre-1970 or 1965, let's say, where they couldn't go that route. It wasn't even an option. So, I mean, that's another area where classic horror really differs from modern horror. And actually, I wanted to, before we go any further with it, I wanted to almost sort of define the terms here so that we can be clear what we're talking about. When you think classic horror, when you talk about classic horror, because I know I have some very specifics in mind, what are you thinking of, let's say, in terms of a time frame? Like, where do you draw the line, or do you?
I guess there's two things that I'm referring to when I talk to classic horror. One are the films that, regardless of era, that just don't seem to age very much, that continue to hold effect, and it doesn't matter when they were made. Of course, obviously, time's the only thing they can prove whether they don't age. But when I'm talking era-wise, the linchpin's 1968, and I'll tell you why. You have three.
Did you say 1968?
1968. Sorry.
Okay. Yes.
I moved away from the mic. You got three films that year. Well, first of all, you have the MPAA finally coming in with a rating system, which allowed films to be released with additional gore and additional blood. Now you had a system with which, you know, the man could say, okay, you're an R-rated film, you're a G-rated film, etc. Second, you had three key films that year, I think, that really define the changing of the era. First, you have Night of the Living Dead, you know, which just completely changed the game from an independently made standpoint. Then you have Rosemary's Baby, which is a big studio production, but it's also a horror film made for adults with an adult sensibility, you know? It's not meant for it wasn't meant for necking teenagers in the theater seats.
Right.
And three, less important to the genre, but more of a symbol, is Targets, where you have Boris Karloff as an aging horror film star about to retire because the horrors of the modern world have overwhelmed his film work, facing off against a sniper. And that brilliant scene where he is so disgusted by the actions of the sniper that he just starts walloping him with his cane. I love that scene so much.
I actually have always held the same opinion. And I'm glad you mentioned the year 1968, because I too agree that that was the turning point, not just of, and I say maybe 67 and 68, not just of horror movies, but of movies in general, because you've got the, well, you've got the, like you said, the MPAA ratings coming into play. Not only that, but you also have, I think the MPAA ratings had already existed for a year or two, but there really weren't any movies coming out to challenge it until this moment in time. And in 67, you had Bonnie and Clyde, and you had In Cold Blood, which I really see those two movies from a mainstream point of view as being the beginning of quote-unquote modern movies, because they, I mean, in so many ways, it's sort of like the prototype of the modern motion picture. And then the follow, and then you've got, you had it happening in science fiction, because that was also the point in time where you had Planet of the Apes and 2001, which basically broke science fiction away from being, you know, of what it had been before, more or less.
Bug-eyed monsters and mad scientists.
Yeah, and also stuff that might have been a little more oriented for children as well. That was part of it, too. And that was also, I think, part of the horror thing, too, because, well, you know, you had, like you said, Night of the Living Dead, Rosemary's Baby. I had never even considered Targets. That's very interesting as a symbol. But Night of the Living Dead and Rosemary's Baby being the turning point, I absolutely agree. And I think a big part of what changed, though, was that I guess because you didn't have as much in the way of family, quote-unquote family movies. You didn't have the G rating yet. You didn't have too much going on specifically at children, except with the possible exception of Disney stuff, that most movies had to be more or less acceptable for people of any age to watch at any time. You had, you know, people of all ages going to see the same movies a lot more than you did now. And I think that's why, as frightening as classic horror films get, they never, in my opinion, more or less, they very rarely go beyond what I would consider more than a child could handle. I don't know if you would agree with me on that. And that's why I think that the both of us grew up on these movies, because our parents felt that they were okay for us to see. And I feel the same way about my kids now. And I know that my grandparents, when they were children, were seeing these movies in the theater. And the difference is with Night of the Living Dead is you're not going to leave your kid in a movie theater watching Night of the Living Dead.
Yes. I only wish that were true. I have experiences growing up in Iowa with some friends of my parents who were more than happy to let their kids watch that kind of material.
Well, yeah, that's true. But I do think that, you know, there was an acceptability, let's say, not that I lived in the 30s, but for example, in the 30s, I don't think anybody would have had any issue with somebody taking their kids to go see Dracula or Frankenstein or The Bride of Frankenstein. I would venture to assume that a large amount, that those movies were very popular with children at the time.
Actually, in Britain, they were banned for children.
In where?
In Britain.
In Britain, they were banned.
Right, in many places across the world, some states still had their own censorship boards at the time, and many states actually censored their viewing for children.
But not here, though. They weren't banned here for children, were they?
Not nationwide. There was no nationwide ban for children in place, but certain state boards had their own setup and their own rules about how these worked. They would often maul these films, cut full minutes out of them to make sure they were acceptable for children.
I know that happened with Frankenstein, that there was material taken out. But again, I find it interesting, though, that there was an effort being made not in order, you know, to make a horror film. Now, think about that for a second. Make a horror film acceptable for children. Now, that's not really something you would have happen now. You know what I mean? They wouldn't take an R-rated movie and say, okay, guys, we need to rein this in for the kids, you know?
Oh, sure they do when they put it for broadcast on national television, but that's another matter entirely, obviously. That's just cold consumerism.
But not for the theatrical release or you know, not for the release in general. Like, they're not going to say to them, well,
no,
put this movie out, because there's an understanding, I think, more so now that there are certain films that are very intense and that are only meant for on paper for grown-ups.
Well, heck, on DVD, they even ramp it up. Hey, you want more blood? You want more guts? Check our unrated extended cut, now with 3 billion more gallons of blood. I just love that.
I was going to say, so that's why I when I think of classic horror, I do think pre-1968. That's really my cutoff. There's certain subdivisions within that. Like I would consider, you know, the horror of the 30s and 40s a different era from the stuff of the 50s and 60s. But I definitely consider that all to be in the realm of classic horror.
There was a definite paradigm shift. I mean, even though there's definitely different eras between the 30s and 40s, 50s, 60s, there's a definite hard shift in not only the tone, but also the subject matter of these films going into the, you know, you had a lot more sadism. You had a lot more human monsters. Not that there weren't human monsters back in the day, but they were usually couched in very, oh, look at these people back in the 18th century who were so awful to each other, or look at these people who were in the distant past who were so awful to each other. We're not awful like this anymore. Now you had the Texas Chainsaw Massacre coming in. You had all the slasher films coming in. Suddenly people were being awful to people, and they were being awful to people today, which I think actually has a lot to do with the visuals we saw in the Vietnam War on television back in the day. Not that I was alive at the time, but I've heard.
Well, you know, that's true. And I was talking about this in the recent one that I mentioned to you, the conversation that I had with my dad, that Psycho is a big one for that, because that sort of introduced the idea, although it had existed before, I guess, you know, like Peter Lorre and M and things like that. But Psycho really is like the beginning of that concept of just the regular guy living next door to you could be far worse than Dracula or the Wolfman or anybody else. And that sort of grew into, you know, all the stuff that we see now.
But what's interesting is that these cruelties do actually exist in the older films if you know where to look for them. Psycho has its antecedents in a film called Hangover Square that Fox did in 1945, which also involved a person who became someone else at times of distress, and it was all psychological. Let's see, and there was a really interesting movie in 1933 called Murders in the Zoo, where the villain actually sews someone's mouth shut, and you get to see the results.
Oh, wow. You know, I don't think I've ever seen that. That's very interesting. And when you bring that up, too, especially the time frame, what I'm also thinking of are the Val Lewton movies in the 40s. Were also, maybe for budgetary reasons, but in part very human-based. You know, movies like The Body Snatcher and Bedlam and things like that, you know, where the monstrosity exists within regular people, so-called regular people. And not, they really aren't, those really aren't monster movies, you know?
Right. And those were the ones I was referring to when they were careful to couch it in times of the past, you know? But at the same time, The Body Snatcher is actually one of my all-time favorite horror films. If you catch me at the right time, I'll say it's my favorite. But Val Lewton, I have to say, the Val Lewton unit at RKO did some of the best work with using nothing more than a couple $1,000 and shadows. You know, it was brilliant. And yeah. You know, there's not enough people who watch them. I mean, we finally got a DVD set like 6 years ago, and still, there are people who have no idea that these brilliant films exist, and they really need to get out there more.
I agree, and the Val Lewton thing, it's very interesting to me. Actually, The Body Snatcher, I would agree that, I mean, it's not my favorite of all time, but it is up there, especially talking about horror films in the 40s, where I think for a large part of the 40s, I think Universal was sort of kind of losing its way a bit. I mean, I don't want to, not that I don't, I mean, I loved when all those Universal monster mashup movies and stuff, but they're more fun. I consider them more fun and kind of, you know, campy, and Universal was sort of losing its edge. And I really think that the Val Lewton movies in the 40s were the strongest horror movies made in that era. And actually Boris Karloff himself, the performance in that movie I would have to say, disregarding the Frankenstein monster in the original, which I think is in a class by itself and it's unique, he has no lines, obviously. That might be, The Body Snatcher might be his best horror movie performance.
I have to agree. I just finished reading Gregory Manck's book on Bela Lugosi and Boris Karloff, and what really emerged from that book was a masterful, the picture of two very good actors, both with very different styles. And I'm always, it's interesting to read a book like that because he's very careful not to try to bias anyone towards Karloff or Lugosi through his words, but you end up coming off knowing exactly what kind of fan you are, and I'm definitely a Karloff fan.
I find as an actor that I looking at him, from the both of them as actors, I tend to prefer Karloff myself as well. I mean, I just feel like he was more of a well-rounded, versatile actor. Like, to put it this way, I think even if the horror genre had not entered his life, I think there's a good chance that he could have still had a fine career as an actor doing lots of other things. Whereas I think that Lugosi, if it wasn't for Dracula, I think that he probably would have just been seen as sort of this, kind of weird European, guy with an accent who couldn't speak English all that well. And, I think that he was great as Dracula, but I wouldn't put him in a class of actor as a Boris Karloff.
And I would agree. I do like a good Lugosi film here and there, but yeah, he's a more of an interesting character than he is an interesting actor. But I don't want to get into the I don't want to get too deeply into the Karloff and Lugosi wars. It's that's a whole hot button topic there.
It is, really, isn't it? And I think that book just took it to a whole other level. I picked it up off the shelf recently at a bookstore, and I was just kind of paging through it. I haven't really have I didn't buy it, and I haven't read it yet. But I am very interested too, because it's an interesting topic. Personally, like I said, I don't even really put them in the same class with each other. But it is interesting, and I guess they both have their fans. I personally, since we're talking about classic horror, I am crazy about the original Dracula, and it's one of those movies that the more I watch it, the more I appreciate it. I remember, a lot earlier, I always found Frankenstein far superior, and I wouldn't even I wasn't even that crazy about the Lugosi one. I was one of those people in the Hammer camp that always went for the Christopher Lee version, because I think I grew up with those Hammer movies being on syndicated TV a lot. But rewatching that 31 Dracula a couple of times, it is absolutely astonishing, and he's a big part of it. I mean, it's become such an icon now that we almost take it for granted. But if you strip everything away and you just watch it, he is amazing in that movie.
Yeah, see, I'm more than happy to take that film for granted, actually. I note its importance to the genre. I think that it's a very bold film and that it was trying something that really hadn't been done before, especially in sound horror, in the sound era. But it doesn't work for me. I just, there's just too much. There's too much back and forth. You can kind of tell which days Todd Browning was drunk on and which days he wasn't. And there's all those gaffes, like the armadillos in Transylvania. It's so weird. I can get around so many different things, but when it comes to Dracula, for some reason, I hone in on the flaws. I don't know why that is.
Well, I find, I think what happens with the problem with that movie is it sort of devolves into like a parlor room melodrama as it moves along. But for me, the earlier parts of it, especially the stuff in Transylvania itself, and even when Dracula first arrives in England, I find it to be very powerful stuff. And I think a big part of it is the photography. It's Carl Freund and the kind of camera movement and stuff that was going on. I just feel like you don't see it that much in movies from that era. I love 1930s films, especially early 30s. And part of the reason is I always find them to be really exciting because they were still learning how to make movies, especially sound movies. and there's a lot of experimentation going on. But a big problem with a lot of them is that they hadn't really learned a lot about or even had the ability yet to do a lot of interesting camera movement and interesting shots. And that movie, for me, really stands out because especially early on, it has some amazing work done, especially the first reveal of Dracula in the catacombs under the castle. I always find it to be amazing.
That is one of the great iconic moments in horror. I will give you that. I will hand it over because it's, you know, you nailed that one. It's brilliant.
And I love the stuff too, the early stuff between him and Renfield in the castle itself is very, it's almost like ritualistic because you know what it's all about. It's like, it's almost like the horror's version of, you know, the nativity scene. There's nothing that's going to surprise you, but the way it plays out and the way they play their parts, it just, something about it, it just really affects me.
It's the idea, for me, it's the idea that Dracula could have taken this guy when he walked in.
Yes.
But he was so, he decides to play polite. He decides to play the host, not because he has to, but because he can. And that's creepifying enough.
That's true. And there's that great scene with the brides, which everybody talks about, you know, how Todd Browning wasn't comfortable making movies in sound. And that may or may not be true, I guess, because he was a great silent director before that. But it is true that in a lot of his sound movies like this and Freaks, there are parts that are so strong that tend to be the scenes where words are not important, like the banquet scene in Freaks. That scene, and I know I'm not the first one to say this, but that scene could have very easily played out in a silent movie, and you would not have lost anything. And the same goes in Dracula, that moment with the brides, when Dracula finally shows his colors there. It's absolutely beautiful, the way it's shot, the way it plays out, and there's no words, or if there are words, they're sort of incidental words. And
there's no music.
Yeah, well, there's no music in the entire film, right? Isn't that correct? It has no sound.
Except for in the opening title, Swan Lake.
Yeah, and actually, on the DVD, there was a DVD release a few years ago from Universal. I don't know if you've heard this version. There was a soundtrack.
Glass.
Yeah, the Philip Glass soundtrack. And I've got to say, it's interesting, and I like the music, and I tried watching it with the music, and it did work for me, but I felt like the music was too incessant. It just, it was too overbearing, and I had to take it off because it was taking away from the movie for me. It's like there were not... They went from complete silence to just this wall of music, of nonstop music, and I thought it was a little bit too much.
Well, that's actually something I appreciate about Dracula and also Fritz Lang's M, which is kind of incidental to the horror genre, is that, you know, in a time when people were scrambling to talk throughout the films just to show that they could, you have films that are willing to be silent. You know, whether that was because Todd Browning wasn't comfortable making sound films is almost beside the point. It's, you know, the fact of the matter is that, hey, look, someone's shutting up, finally.
Well, let's, I wanted to talk a little bit about Hammer, too, because that, especially going from those Universal days and the Val Lewton days, you know, Hammer is, it's almost this weird bridge, I always see it, between the classic horror films and the modern horror films, because you have largely the subject matter of the classic horror films, and yet the way it's being treated in terms of the sexuality and the blood level, while it's nothing approaching what was to come in later years, it adds that in. In other words, you get to see a Dracula movie that actually has fangs and blood in it, which you never saw before.
Right, right. Hammer... I love Hammer. I love Hammer to death. If you ask me in another week, I'll say Curse of Frankenstein's my favorite horror film.
Awesome. Yep.
But they made a lot of duds. I mean, they really, once they started milking those franchise machines, they really kind of started to lose their way. And they had the unfortunate mishap, I think, of making classic horror subjects right as the tides of film were starting to turn. They had that good 10 years, starting with the Quatermass films in 1955, right through 1965. And then, you know, Dracula, Prince of Darkness, which is, again, a brilliant film that involves a lot of silence from its main antagonist. And then it's just sort of started to fall apart.
Do you think it was because of the way that that horror movies were changing, that they were sort of seeming to be out of touch? Could that have been part of it?
Oh, I definitely think so. I mean, just look at the Dracula series. I mean, suddenly he's in swinging London in the 1970s, which never swang that much, is from what I can tell from what I've read, apparently, that in 1972 it gone a bit docile, but no, they're still swinging in Dracula's 1972. And oh wait, he's in Satanic Rites of Dracula. He's teaming with hippie motorbikers who wear fur-lined coats for a satanic cult because Satan's big this year.
Well yeah, the Dracula series does kind of go crazy. It just goes nuts with Hammer. You know, it starts off. You know, a lot of people will point to Horror of Dracula, as it was known in the U.S., as their favorite version. And it starts off really strong, and then, as you say, it devolves into a point where it's almost like, as much as I can still enjoy those movies for camp value, I love Dracula in 1872, and I love, you know, Scars of Dracula and those kind of movies. But it had devolved, I think, to the point where they didn't quite even know what to do with the character anymore. You had Christopher Lee almost being wasted because he barely spoke. It was almost like he was more of a symbol than even a character. He would just show up here and there. Somebody would die, then he would disappear. And it was almost like he was almost tangential to the plot a lot of times.
In his autobiography, he would kind of note how the production of those films would go. They would say they would get the funding based on Christopher Lee playing Dracula, and he would say, "No, no, I'm not going to do this one." And then they'd say, "Okay, fine, let's write a film that we can put Dracula into later because we're totally going to get Chris Lee on this." And finally, they come to Christopher and they say, "Look at all the people you're going to put out of work if you're not in our movie." And he's like, "Fine."
I believe it because, you know, what's the one where it's the bunch of guys who they're these bored kind of rich English gentlemen and they make this satanic pact with each other and then Dracula.
Taste the Blood of Dracula.
Ah, okay. Taste the Blood of Dracula, right. Now that one, that might be kind of the turning point because yeah, when I see that movie, it's like he just sort of pops up to kill one of them and then he'll pop up again to kill another one. And then, you know, it's compare that to Horror of Dracula where he is really, the movie is about him, you know, and instead, it becomes more about the other characters. It's almost like the equivalent of a Godzilla movie, where you've got all these other characters and their interactions and their narrative, and every now and then Godzilla shows up and destroys some things and disappears.
Yeah, but at least with the Godzilla films, you have a reason. You know, Godzilla can't be destroying throughout the whole movie. You'll lose a whole city that way. You'll lose several cities that way. You know, with Dracula, he's a one-on-one kind of guy. You can get through several more deaths. Not that I'm saying you should. But yeah, I know what you mean with Taste of the Blood of Dracula. I mean, he doesn't even really attack the patriarchs. He attacks their children who then attack their parents. So he's not even really needed for this at all. You know, there could have been some sort of blood curse or something. But, yeah.
We've talked a bit about Universal and Luton and Hammer, and I'd like to, before we wrap it up, I wanted to talk a little bit about, you mentioned briefly at the beginning how a lot of modern horror movies tend to leave you cold, and I want to talk a little bit about what you think changed about horror movies for you.
I think it was, here's the thing. The horror genre is something that requires a very creative mind to exploit properly. And what we're seeing now is that we either have people who are trying to push the limits of human experience in horror films, which I don't have anything against, it's just not my cup of tea, or people who have grown up in the video generation and have literally had access to hundreds of horror films over the course of their childhood. And all they're doing is making mashups of the films they grew up on, which is, again, not problematic, except that sometimes they think just having seen the films is enough to make a good pastiche.
See, I had a problem because of that very reason. I had a problem with Hatchet. And I don't know if you saw Hatchet, but it was a movie that was made, the guy who made it, Adam Green, was a huge fan of, you know, 80s slasher movies growing up, okay? exactly what you're talking about. And he processed all of that, and basically he just kind of regurgitated it into this movie, which, you know, I reviewed it. I didn't enjoy it at all. And my just the, what I took away from it was, okay, you grew up watching these really bad horror movies. You processed it all. You synthesized it all into your own really bad horror movie. Like, what? I don't really know what to say to that. You know, I mean, am I supposed to be impressed by this? Because I wasn't.
I was. I loved Hatchet. I have a Hatchet Army T-shirt in my drawer.
Wow, this is interesting. Okay, let's talk about this. That would not be a movie that I would have expected you to like.
I have a fascination with the slasher subgenre, not because I think many of the films in it are particularly good, but because it kind of goes more to my interest in cinema studies. There's a mythos behind them, I guess. It's sort of, not only in terms of like the Jason series, which has a mythology, but also sort of there's a certain set of tropes you have to hit in each film. And I'm always fascinated with the different ways that each of those tropes are hit. They're the same elements, but yet they're always come at as slight, just 2 degrees off from the last film, you know. And I find it fascinating as a subgenre, not as a set of individual films. So to see those tropes that I'm fascinated in come together in sort of a melange like that, I found it really interesting. And I saw it in the theater when it came out in that limited release. I went with my co-editor at the time, and we just both enjoyed the hell out of ourselves. It was the weirdest thing. I just had a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think my issue with slasher films, I'm not a big fan of them. There are a few exceptions for me, but as a rule, I'm just not a big fan for a couple of reasons. I don't find them frightening, even, and I'm not saying like I have to be terrified literally, you know, every time I watch a horror movie to enjoy it, but I don't even find anything happening in them to be anything that would frighten me, even if I was in the right frame of mind. It almost seems more like they're just built around the idea of you wanting to see these people get killed, which I think is a very different idea from horror movies that had come before. And I think a lot of people grew up, you know, I grew up with those movies. I think a lot of people grew up thinking that the idea of a horror movie is where you want to see the monster win and kill all these people, because that's what slashers engender in you. Whereas traditionally in a horror film, you would be sympathizing with the characters that were being hunted down by the monster.
Well, I think slasher films have a lot in common with comedies, actually. I mean, they even call the individual kills gags in the special effects industry. You know, you in a slapstick comedy, you want to see someone slip on the banana peel or get hit on the head with the anvil or whatever, you know?
Yeah. I find it cynical for that reason, though, you know?
Well, yeah, but at the same time, it's almost, my fascination with it's almost sociological. You know, why? Why are we fascinated enough with this to create an industry out of it, you know? And so I do enjoy watching them from that sort of removed standpoint, but no, as individual entertainments, no. I kind of watch one and I file it away for reference with the others that I watch. Well, I'd be hard-pressed to do an individual review of a single slasher film, I think, although I have.
Yeah, that's the thing, and they don't, it's one of those where, especially when you get to the worst ones, you know, if you've seen one of them, you've seen them all, because it's like this sort of pattern that they all go through, you know. But but anyway, I mean, we can talk about this forever. This is a subject that I really love talking about, because I don't get to talk about it enough. You know, classic horror and the difference between horror of a bygone era and horror of today. It's a fascinating subject for me. I want to thank you for coming around to do this with me, and hopefully we can do it again at a later point. There's a lot more we can talk about.
Definitely. Definitely.
So I want to thank you again. And for anybody interested in classic horror in general, you certainly can do a lot worse than visiting Nate's site, which is classic-horror.com, where you will find 11 years worth of material and reviews and stuff. Actually, I wrote the Saw review, I'm proud to say, on that site. And also, Cinema Geek, cinema-geek.com, where you'll find a lot of great stuff about classic cinema in general. So, again, I want to thank Nate Yap for being a guest this week on Conversations in the Dark.